Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Summertime in the North State is an ideal time to visit the Sacramento River. Later in this hour, I'll ask Anderson author Bob Magic about this transcendental river. My first guests collaborated on a field guide to the birds of Bidwell Park and now have a book about birds' names. Retired English professor Carol Burr is an author, editor, and artist who illustrated The Birds of Bidwell Park. Roger Lederer has published many books and papers in the field of ornithology and collaborated with his wife, Carol Burr, on their previous book, The Birds of Bidwell Park. Their newest book, Latin for Bird Lovers, covers the secrets behind more than 3,000 scientific names of birds and why those names were selected. Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there's a paragraph in your book that especially struck me because I took Latin in high school, and it was not at the time that I appreciated that teacher, but after I graduated, I wrote a letter to this teacher and thanked her for what she had done, what I'd learned from her. So when I saw this paragraph in your book, I was reminded that you thank various people who helped with the creation of this book, and then you say, we would like to thank our high school Latin teachers who had a major influence on us in our careers and pleasures. We didn't realize the benefit at the time, but such is the risk and value in educating the young. And I'm sure that would give encouragement to teachers who feel like maybe at the time, did I really get through to those students? And Carol, you say you taught Victorian literature.
Absolutely.
And so it may be only down the road.
You hope so, because these things are hard work at the time and you're not sure the relevance to your life. And I think it's an argument for not making a determination on relevance until you are at least 60.
Oh, 60.
Yes, I'm pushing it back. I put it back a decade as I pass one. Yes, because I really think young people just don't know, and I think they need everything they can get. So and I do think that this was a very unusual way to come back to something. It was a benefit for vocabulary, and I always appreciated it for that, but not for writing a book about bird lovers here.
So as I read this book, I was thinking that this is a book for bird lovers and a book for word lovers. And I don't know much about birds, but I do love words. So I was imagining as I was reading this that maybe that was the area that you focused on. And then, of course, the expertise on birds, Roger, that's your field.
Yes.
So how did you divide up the assignments of writing this book?
Well, I did more of the scientific kinds of things, and she did the pronunciations and the meaning of some of the words. You know, we both overlap in that Latin area, but it was ornithology that was my thing. And so I tried to pick out the names that were the most commonly used. I mean, there are 10,000 species of birds. So I tried to pick out some of the more common genera and species that, you know, people would see often. So this only covers 3,000 names, but there are 10,000. Somebody did write a book who covered 20,000 names, actually, old ones and new ones, but it's 450 pages long, you know, with a font 10, and it just goes on and on and on. You wouldn't want to read that, but it's a great reference.
Well, speaking of reading, I really enjoyed reading this book, and I hope that people won't think, oh, Latin, I don't know anything about Latin, and think that's all it is, because it's so much more than that. And it was so thought-provoking. I found myself stopping and thinking, oh, I wonder about that, and going to the computer and Googling, for example, New Latin. I thought, New Latin? And so, Roger, you're talking about the pronunciations. And how did you arrive at, Carol, since you did the pronunciation,
yes,
how did you determine what pronunciation? Because there may not be general agreement.
Well, that's true. I mean, I definitely started out not understanding that scientific Latin, New Latin, is post-Renaissance. And I had learned classical Latin.
Which we all do if we study Latin
do.
In high school.
And so I spent the first A and B sections of the book doing classical Latin pronunciations. And then I went back and started understanding better what Carl Linnaeus was doing. And that's really what the pronunciation is a combination, in a way, of some of the ecclesiastical Latin, some of the classical, and then just some of what the scientist sort of decided on. I went back and redid my A's and B's because it was clear that I had not done that correctly. So it was, and then, of course, the other thing that happens with this is that a number of birds have been named after people. And then what we did there was try to make the name as true to its native pronunciation as possible.
Like Linnaeus himself.
Yes.
You often see his name Latin. canonized.
Exactly. Yes. Carolus.
Carolus Linnaeus.
Carolus Linnaeus.
Right.
Yes.
From Carl von Linné.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
my guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, and they have a new book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And we're talking about the Latin aspect, but there's so much more in this book than just a list of these names that birds get two names. And what other information did you decide to include in this book, Roger?
Well, we have some biographies of birdwatchers or famous ornithologists, and we put a couple in there who I thought were really interesting. James Bond, a lot of people.
I thought that was,
yeah,
yes.
A lot of people don't know that James Bond was actually an ornithologist, a well-known one. And Ian Fleming, who met him in Jamaica, eventually met him in Jamaica, actually named a character 007 after James Bond without asking James Bond. And then they finally met, and in fact, it was filmed by BBC. And then the other one is Phoebe Snetsinger, who I thought was a terrific woman. Phoebe Snetsinger spent some 20 years. After she was diagnosed with terminal cancer, she spent another 20 years, took up bird watching, and saw more birds than anybody else in the world up until that point. And she was killed in a car accident in Madagascar, but she got to be really well known because of what she did.
Mm-hmm. You know what else I found, besides the fact that James Bond was a real person, he was an ornithologist, but I imagined this figure being born in England. He was born in Philadelphia.
Right.
And ended up dying in Philadelphia. But this real person, James Bond, was actually born in the United States.
Right.
His father was British, you say, in your book.
The other thing I think that's really interesting about the book is that when we were talking about putting the book together, there was a book called Latin for Gardeners. And it gave the term, and it gave the plant, but it didn't make the connection between the scientific name and the name by which we tend to know the plant. And I thought what Roger had added to the mix was trying at least in a fairly contracted way to explain why a bird might be called something, sort of why. Maybe you can give a good example.
Well, there's a lot of names that are pretty standard. They're named after colors, they're named after people, they're named after shapes, and, spotted or striped, fasciata is striped. Those kinds of things, but I had a hard time finding a few things, and one of them was imperfecta. One was named something imperfecta, was a species name, and I'm trying to figure out why would they name this imperfecta? And it took me hours, but I finally found a paper written in the 1800s that described the specimen. All these names are based on one specimen that was collected somewhere, which is why, like the great horned owl, Boo Boo virginianus, because it was first described in Virginia. And so this bird named imperfecta, why would they name it imperfecta? Well, it turns out at that time they used to shoot birds, and this one was so badly shot up, it was missing half its feathers and was an imperfect specimen, so they named it imperfecta, which of course really has nothing to do with the living bird.
The bird itself, mm-hmm. Yeah. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Their book is Latin for Bird Lovers. They're both retired professors from California State University. And it makes for a very interesting collaboration because I was always interested in biology and languages and thought, well, now how could those possible be there an overlap there? But there is in your case. So in your book, you give the list of the scientific names. People can look that up. You give profiles of people who have contributed to our knowledge of birds. And you have topics about birds that I found so fascinating. And for example, feathers. I mean, we know what feathers are, but when I read your section on feathers, I thought, I had no idea.
Mm.
So what did you include in your section on feathers that might surprise people like me?
Well, I just got done reading another book actually on feathers, which had a lot more detail than this does.
But your information is very concise, and I like that.
But it's very concise. Well, the feathers are amazing. I mean, they produce insulation, they produce lift, they produce not only insulation for the bird, but insulation for the babies. They produce either fast flight or slow flight. There's all kinds of different feathers. The pin feathers are tactile, so the bird knows where his other feathers are. Those kinds of things. They're amazing inventions.
Well, for example, I don't know if listeners noticed the order in which you said that. You didn't say that feathers are for flight, which most of us assume, well, that's why feathers evolve for flight. But you said you named insulation first.
That's apparently why they evolved insulation. Although there's some discussion about that. Maybe the first reason they came about was just insulation. We know dinosaurs, birds are modern dinosaurs. We know dinosaurs, some of them were warm-blooded, and they had to, you know, insulate themselves somehow so they didn't lose their body heat, and feathers are one way of doing it. Some of the new information also says that it used to be that feathers evolved from scales of reptiles. They didn't. They were separate evolutionary process to produce feathers. There was some argument about that, but over the last 12 years or so, they've decided that's probably what it is.
So feathers for insulation, feathers for flight, and then there's a third use of feathers, or fourth.
For decoration. Obviously, they've become, you look at the birds of paradise, they're absolutely amazing animals who have this sexual selection. They have all these displays with their fancy feathers as well as sounds that attract females.
So they're feathers for courtship, but also for camouflage. Some of these little tiny birds are pretty vulnerable.
You know, cryptic coloring is very important. The other thing I thought was fascinating about the owls is they have sort of fraying on the feather so they can fly silently. And for a predator, that's not a bad strategy.
You sneak up on your prey if your feathers are quiet.
Yeah, except in the case of Pell's fishing owl that feeds on fish, they don't fly silently, but you don't have to
if they're underwater. Yeah. Well, there are these specialized feathers that you mentioned, and I thought it was interesting that from what you described, I imagine that for the reason that cats have whiskers, like little feelers out there, that birds actually have bristles.
Right. That was actually my first research project in graduate school. I filmed these birds at 400 frames per second and watched how they use their bristles. They don't use them to catch flies. What we think they're used for is to indicate how fast a bird is going. So he turns left, turns right. You know, just like when you close your eyes, you know which way you're going and you know where your arms are. Well, the bristles do the same thing. They tell the bird how fast he or she is going and, you know, in what direction and down, up, and those kinds of things.
My guests are Carol Burr and Roger Lederer, and they have collaborated on the book Latin for Bird Lovers. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol's specialty is language, literature, and so they've collaborated on this book that includes lots of words. And Carol, you probably were in charge maybe of the listing of the nomenclature, the two, and of course binomial means two names.
Yes.
Why don't you explain how that came about, or what you, the work you did for the binomial that is redundant, actually binomial nomenclature, but forgive me.
That's definitely really Roger's initiative, but we wanted to include the genus and the species, and it's a way of understanding the relationship between birds. And of course our understanding of what constitutes a species is that the birds can interbreed and produce healthy offspring, and I think that's probably still the main taxonomical reason for determining. And apparently there's a lot of change. One of the things we sort of did a caveat in the introduction is that because of DNA and other things, it's changing.
It's
a moving target, very much so, and it's getting more and more sophisticated with the DNA analysis. But and I think that was why there the other side pieces, in addition to the mm-hmm. names, is a discussion mm-hmm. of the different genera, the different, to some extent family as well. But we focused on the genus and the species, like Homo and sapiens. And Homo is, of course, the larger category, but then sapiens is the one that we, as opposed to erectus or some of the other species categories.
You also, here's the English teacher, and you give a warning to the reader about the word species is both singular and plural.
Well, the species has nothing to do with species.
That is a word, yes. Species
it is a word. It is a word.
It's a gold coin.
It's a gold coin, yes. It will not help you with ornithology. But, and that's also true, that genuses is not what it's general. And so I guess we sort of were, trying to kind of make that accurate, so that mm-hmm. because I think what's appealing about this to some extent is that when you are a bird watcher and common names, even though Roger has explained that there are official common names for birds that are understood internationally, but frequently birds will have more than one sort of regional name that's been given to the bird, and so this is really a way of understanding birds globally, and I think it's one of the few animals that has this clarity in terms of naming. So it's appropriate.
Right, exactly. The whole purpose of scientific name, well, it's two purposes. One is to put the birds in a relationship with every other organism. Every living organism has a scientific name. And they all have a classification, started with kingdom, down, you know, and we go through fish or birds or whatever it happens to be. And so every scientific name denotes exactly where these organisms lie in the whole scheme of biology. And it gives international workers a way to communicate with one another. I've been to international congresses, you know, with people speaking different languages, and if we had a different name for every bird, we wouldn't know what we're talking about. So they have specific common names. But as Carol said, I mean, specific scientific names, but as Carol said, there are common names. The International Ornithological Congress has decided on common names for all 10,000 birds, common English names. Now, they may call them something else in Africa or Asia, but in English-speaking countries, there are official common names. It makes it a lot handier for us, especially when we go on bird walks and we say, that's a scrub jay and not a F. Olcoma cirrillescens, which people couldn't write down nearly as fast.
It's very interesting. And, of course, some of the bird names, some of the scientific names are based on the call, the bird call. And so Roger has the one that's become the most popular when we're explaining this.
You know, people ask about that. What's your favorite name or favorite bird? And I don't really have one, but the one that's most interesting to me is there's a bird called a hoopoe, which you may have seen because you were in France lately. They are mm-hmm. in France. He's like a little orange kind of woodpecker that pokes on the ground. Really interesting bird. It's one of a kind. It's its own species and genus and family and order. And it's Eupupa epops is a scientific name. It's named after the sound as well as the name hoopoe. But it also in its own family, Eupupidae, and its own order, Eupupiformes. So when I give this talk sometime, I'll say this bird is in Eupupiformes, Eupupidae, Eupupa epops, the hoopoe.
He's the only one I know who can say that.
Well, that sounds like the sound that the bird makes. So
yes.
That's the source of some names, the sound that the bird makes himself. I'm always interested in that in other languages when the name of the bird, commonly used, is the sound that the bird makes, an imitation of that. You mentioned that some of them are named for the person, not really the person that maybe gave the name,
right,
but named for some person.
It is an honorary thing. I mean, mm-hmm.
So you don't name it for yourself.
You don't name it for yourself.
That's sort of unwritten rule. You don't do that.
Right. And it's generally meant as a kind of a tribute to that mm-hmm. person. I know when Audubon named the Bewick's wren, it was named after Thomas Bewick, or Bewick, depending on which Englishman you talk to. He was an ornithologist in England, and so you know, when you come to the names, it's sort of interesting because you'd learn a little bit about the person for whom the bird was mm-hmm. named. So.
So they're named for people, for
yes.
the sound they make.
Yes, for their behavior.
For their behavior.
Right, for their habitat in some cases, for their coloration, for their, for example, whether they have a crest on the top of the head or whether they have bands on the wings, the shape of the tail. And so there are some words that you'll find repeating themselves because they're rhincus for nose and mm-hmm. ura for tail and... I'm trying to think, cephala for head, and you'll find that a number of the names, then you start going, oh, there's another cephala, another thing where it's something about the shape of the head or the color of the head. And one example that Roger has explained, and I think it's fascinating, is the bald eagle, which actually is not bald. Obviously, it has white feathers, and that's because the bald is actually coming from piebald. I thought that was an interesting kind of explanation of something. You're going, why mm-hmm. is it a bald eagle? No, it's a piebald eagle. Mm-hmm. So it's actually a lot of fun when you start noticing all the different reasons for the bird name. And most of them are descriptive. Some of them are based on mythology, which can throw you completely for a loop. And then the origin of the language is really Indo-European, but it came through the Greek and then the Latin. And so you have some names that are really looking quite Greek in origin, mm-hmm. others that are clearly Latin, and then some that you're going, okay, well, they obviously wanted to make it like the sound of the bird, and it's not coming from anywhere familiar. And then the mythology is very complicated.
Well, can you give us an example of one name for behavior of the bird?
Okay, now I did. I wrote something down on that. Let's see if I can do this here. The red-winged blackbird, Agelaus phoeniceus, is named for its behavior because it's a gregarious bird, and that's where the Agelaus comes from. And then also in the phoeniceus, that's a wing coloration, which is deep red. So sometimes you'll get a combination of behavior and color, or okay, and habitat. Let me see, what do we find? What did I find for habitat?
I can think, well, common names, Savannah sparrow, Savannah, and marsh wren, and those kinds of things,
right.
Reed warbler.
Now, you mentioned color.
Yes.
And something that I found fascinating was that this bird we call the red-breasted robin, and you think, well, but that's not red. And I grew up, my hair isn't very red now, but I grew up, people call their hair red, but it really wasn't red. It was orange.
Right.
And I found out from reading your book about the color orange.
Right.
And what happened with that?
They didn't have a word for orange at the time. It was all sort of one color, red. I mean, like now, when you go to paint samples, you know, 10,000 different names for blue or red. Well, they only had simple names for those things, and they only had a few dyes here and there, so they just didn't have one for orange.
Right.
Well, my husband always thought that men in particular were limited in their range of colors. They knew about three basic colors, and so I thought about that when you said you said the color orange wasn't even known as a color until the 16th century.
16th century, right.
That was amazing to me. So this red-breasted robin, of course, is actually orange. So the terminology, the names that are applied, sometimes puzzle us, like you were talking about the bald eagle. What were some other surprises as you researched these names?
Well, I mean, there's some like the red-bellied woodpecker doesn't have a red belly, but it has a little tiny pink wash. And that came from the fact that whoever named it had it in his hand, a dead specimen, saw the pink very close up and said, oh, a red-bellied woodpecker. But you're seeing in the field, you can't find that red belly. So there are a number of things like that that come from artifacts. And some of these things they've cleaned up, and some they just, you know, it's just sort of interesting. So they'll keep it, everybody understands.
My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. Roger is an ornithologist, and Carol especially was English in language. So you collaborated on this, and you mentioned, Roger, you're often asked about your favorite bird, and you like the name, saying the name. I have a favorite bird, too, and that's the crow. And so I was very interested in what you had to say about the crow. What do people find interesting about crows?
They're very smart. Some of them are particularly smart. It depends on which crow you're talking about. There are bunches of them, but they're all, the whole crow family is probably the most intelligent of birds. There have been studies on New Caledonian crow, which is a special species just found in New Caledonia. They can actually make tools. Now, some birds use tools, but they actually make tools, break little branches, make little hooks out of them so they can get the fruit and things like that. Lots of experiments done on crows. Corvus brachyrhynchos, the crow with a wide bill.
Well, speaking of bills, because you have a section in your book, one of these topics, is on beaks. And you say that the beaks are a reflection of a bird's lifestyle. And there's a photograph. By the way, your book visually is so reader-friendly. I really enjoyed, and maybe your editor did all that, but it was very easy to read. You'd have boxes, Latin in action over on the side, beautiful color pictures of the birds.
Yeah, they did a nice job
laying it out. They did a beautiful job visually. So I get this picture of the rhinoceros hornbill, and that is really a bizarre beak.
Right.
Describe to people what that beak looks like.
Well, it's a big, heavy beak, that down-curved beak, but on top of it is another horn, rhinoceros kind of horn that sticks up. And what most hornbills do is the male walls the female in a hole in a tree and then walls it in with mud so the female can only stick her beak out and he can only stick his beak in, and she raises the eggs and young in there. It's a way of protection. And if a predator comes along, they stick their beak out, big heavy beak, both for feeding and for protection.
Yeah, so here's this bird that has one beak. I mean, most beaks are rather elegant looking. They're I think, visually pleasing. And here's this bird with this rhinoceros horn on top of his beak. And that really is bizarre looking.
Yeah, the shoebill that we saw in Uganda was an incredible looking beak. So maybe you can explain a little bit about that.
Well, it's a big, odd bird. It's about five, 6 feet tall, fairly rare. And it's got a beak as big as a size 12 shoe. And it looks like a shoe.
Looks actually. Like a shoe.
Yeah.
That's hard to imagine.
Pretty amazing. But what I said about birds' beaks reflect their lifestyle, because that's their tool. If you had only one tool, like you had a pair of pliers or you had a hammer, And that's all you had. That's all you can make your living with. There's only certain things you can do. And so birds with really long bills live very different life than birds with really short bills and so on.
Well, and that whole thing with the Galapagos finches, because each island had a different food source to some extent. So the beaks reflected, the food source and what the birds needed to survive on that particular island. I mean, that was something that Darwin really did quite a bit of work on. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. It is. This whole thing that you can look at the bird's beak and tell what his lifestyle is. What always amazes me, too, when I find a bird's nest, say, on the ground or a tree, and I look at that and imagine I could not possibly, with my 10 fingers and tools at my disposal, create what this bird has created with his beak and a talon. I find that incredible.
Typically, just with the beak, they may bring, certain birds can bring things in, but most of them will just use their beak, and some of them will take weeks. The weaver birds of Africa will take 3 or 4 weeks to build a big, long, hanging nest up in a tree somewhere so predators can't get to them. So, and some of them, the oven birds of South America, will build these birds that look like bake ovens that the natives used to use, all made out of mud.
But I'm always astounded that with just that beak, they can build that. Yeah. And I also was interested in the fact that the beak has some parts that are sensitive and some parts, obviously, like our fingernails and hair, we can cut our fingernails and hair and we don't feel any pain. But skin is in that same thing. We feel that in the skin. So how does a bird's beak help them in as far as sensitivity?
Well, the birds that are probing in the ground are probing like in sand, like a whimbrel or some or a willet, something like that. They'll stick their bill into the sand, and they can find prey that way. And they can actually don't have to touch it. They don't have to feel it. They don't have to see it. They can sense it with pressure-sensitive corpuscles in their bills. And then they can find out where this thing is.
Yeah, that is amazing to me. My guests are Roger Lederer and Carol Burr. And they have collaborated on a book, Latin for Bird Lovers. And that's the title here in the United States, and I think in England, Latin for Bird Lovers. But I understand in Australia, they've given it a different title.
Latin for Bird Watchers.
Bird Watchers.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. I sort of argued for the Latin for Bird Watchers in the first place, but the people who know about marketing and things like that and the publishing, they said they decided Bird Lovers. I said, well, okay.
Well, when I was back before now, I considered people who were interested in birds, bird watchers, and they call themselves, I hear around Chico, birders.
Well, there's a fine line of difference. It's like bird watchers are generally considered people sitting in their kitchen and looking out at the birds at their feet or walking down the block and seeing a couple of finches in the gutter somewhere. And while birders are out, they go out to go watch birds. That's their whole purpose in life. Or when they go out and look for things.
But they're the big ear people. Did you see the film with Steve Martin? It was about these guys competing to who could see the most North American birds in a year. And one went bankrupt in the process. I mean, these are people who are diehard, the birders.
I know some people who travel all over the world doing that.
Solely for that.
So there is a distinction then between bird watchers and birders.
Yeah, but it's a pretty loose distinction. In England, they call them twitchers. Mm-hmm. The avid bird watchers.
Thank you for taking us on this fascinating adventure with birds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guests have been Roger Lederer and Carol Burr, and their new book is Latin for Bird Lovers.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Anderson author Bob Magic will tell us about the Sacramento River, which he calls transcendental. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. After a career in public education in the San Francisco Bay Area, today's guest moved to Shasta County, a move inspired by the Sacramento River. Author Bob Magic has a BA from Amherst College, an MA and PhD from Stanford University. He has lived in Anderson for 20 years now. He and his wife live in a home overlooking the Sacramento River. He feels that the Sacramento is one of the most important rivers in the world, and yet a human and natural history of this river had never been written. So Bob Magic has written the river's story in his newest book, The Sacramento, A Transcendent River. Bob Magic, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Did it take you as long to write this book as it did the one before?
Just about. This was 6 years of work, and the other book was about as long.
So I might mention the title of your last book was Shattered Air, A True Account of Catastrophe and Courage on Yosemite's Half Dome.
Yes.
Have you spent a lot of time there in Yosemite?
Well, as a young family, we camped there, and this story caused me to spend much more time. I gave the program, I have a program related to the book, a PowerPoint program, and I presented that at the Sierra Club Center in Yosemite Valley, at least 8 or 9 times. So the book caused us to spend much more time, my wife and me, in Yosemite, and that was a good thing. That was a good thing. National Geographic also did a documentary on Yosemite called Secret Yosemite, and they featured Shattered Air as one of the elements in the book. So that brought us to Yosemite, and we're part of that film.
Did you have as many photographs in your previous book as you do in your new book?
Not at all. Not at all. The previous book was mainly a textual account of that catastrophe, and there were maybe a dozen or 15 black and white pictures, but the pictorial element was not as important as in this book.
It is important, and I really enjoyed the photographs. You've got, I think, over 190 photographs, color photographs.
That's true.
In your new book, The Sacramento, A Transcendent River. Do you have a favorite photograph?
Well,
I have several. That's why I'm asking you.
I have one of a hawk overlooking a shrouded part of the river that I took right from our deck, and I see that scene every morning that we wake up. And I might just mention that many of the photos in the book are the result of some local photographers who I was able to draw upon, such as Bruce King, who's a local farmer, but his hobbies are flying and photography. So I think a half a dozen aerial photos of his are in the book. And there are other local persons whom I did draw upon for their photos, which really enhanced the book.
One that I liked was, it was really, I was amazed somebody could snap that moment when a Department of Fish and Game officer was releasing a banded pintail duck. And the duck was just in flight, just beyond his reach. You could see the officer's hand reaching out. And that was one of the pictures that I liked. I liked a lot of them, but that was
one. That does convey a very nice image.
I thought so, too. A Sacramento Valley red fox.
Yes.
I was amazed that whoever got that photograph got the fox's face.
And that is a native fox. Now, the red fox is not native, and that's more prevalent throughout California. The gray foxes are native, but the Sacramento Valley red fox is a native. I don't want to ruin that picture for you, but I asked the photographer how he happened to snap that, because I was as amazed as you.
Yes.
Well, they just released it. They just released it from captivity where they, I guess, were examining it and so forth. Mm-hmm. So they happened to just be perfect.
Yes, because it looked like the photographer caught the red fox just as he was going to take a drink from the river.
Yes. Beautiful picture. I love that picture.
And I love the ones, close-up pictures of birds and fish, particularly the birds. I really would just stare at the picture because it was so clear and so sharp, and just you could see the personality of that birdie.
And for those, I'm thankful to Mike Peters, who's an officer with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and works on the wildlife refuges throughout the valley, Sacramento Wildlife Refuge. And I was able to draw upon his many, many photographs, and they, too, just enriched the book dramatically.
I like so many of them. I think if I had to pick a favorite, it would be one that probably you didn't think too much about. But there's a little blonde girl with her back to the camera, and she's watching this. And I don't know that I want to call it a flock, because these were bats rather than birds. But I thought, yes, that's why Bob wrote this book for the future generations, that little girl.
If you ask me that question again, with that prompt, I would have said, that's my favorite picture.
So you liked it too.
Oh, by all means. And I worked hard to have the photographer, in this case, give me a good copy of that picture. Now, it wasn't too long after that I could have duplicated that picture with our own granddaughters, because we went there. This is the Yolo Causeway, and that is a bat flyout, which happens throughout the summer and so forth. And I did take a picture very similar, but that is precious.
It is, and I think some children might have, I guess bats have kind of a creepy reputation, but this little girl was just fascinated with this sky full of bats.
Yes, that reputation is very much undeserved, and I treat it in a long extended sidebar in the book, The mm-hmm. World of Bats, mm-hmm. which I'm pleased to have presented.
My guest is Bob Magic. He lives in Anderson on the Sacramento River. His book is The Sacramento, A Transcendent River. Now, let's go back to in the history of the Sacramento. You and I can never see the Sacramento as it originally was. When, in your opinion, and I think from reading your book, that we as human beings started to have an adverse effect on this river?
Well, it happened in the mid-19th century when settlers moved into Sacramento and then immediately started, well, they didn't immediately because a few floods is what caused them to move in this direction, to build levees and to start controlling the river. In fact, after a major flood in the 1860s, they actually raised the streets of the old Sacramento, today's old Sacramento.
In fact, you have a photo in your book.
That's right. You can see the brick underpinnings. So it was the building of levees which resulted in straightjacking the river in many, many sections. And then the gold mining era was just devastating. The hydraulic mining that took place up in the Yuba River and many of the other tributaries just unleashed massive torrents of debris and slickens that found their way down the Feather River and the American River, flooded towns like Marysville, and ended up in the Sacramento River, causing the river to lose a lot of its depth and reducing the navigability of the river for boats. So that was just devastating. Mining has had a devastating impact on our state on our country.
You gave an amount to help us imagine this: how much of this earth was moved by gold mining. You said there was 8 times the amount of earth dug for the Panama Canal.
Is that amazing? Yes.
It is amazing because we think of this huge trench that was dug for the Panama. We hear the stories about the Panama Canal and imagine all the dirt that was moved to create this canal, and yet 8 times that amount of earth.
Yes, and all of that came from Sierra Nevada mountains, which were left, you know, in themselves greatly adversely impacted.
Well, on a more fun note, the Sacramento has often stood in for the Mississippi in movies.
That's right. It has, many movies.
I wondered if people realized that, because they probably didn't pay that much attention. Here just go a couple of kids rafting down the river
right. And
assume, well, there they are on the Mississippi, but they were actually on the Sacramento.
Especially that the 1957, was it, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, which had such a great cast, Mickey Rooney and others.
Yeah. Well, you talk about the river steamers, like the Antelope was one in particular that plied the river. How far up could people go if they were coming up the Sacramento, say, from the San Francisco Bay?
Well, the furthest most outpost was Red Bluff, where boats regularly trafficked. In fact, if you go to Red Bluff today, you see a lot of evidence of Victorian architecture that the people from San Francisco sort of transported. The founder of Redding tried to create a town in Redding and have it be a boating outlet, a boating outpost. And there were boats that got as far as Redding. There's some suspicion that he dynamited parts of the Iron Canyon area in order to do that. That's never been confirmed. So the boats did reach Redding, larger boats. But that didn't last long, and Red Bluff remained the furthest most northern outpost. When the trains came, that ended.
In fact, that ended the stagecoach popularity, too. In fact, that surprised me when you said the stagecoach era was only 25 years.
Yes.
Because in my imagination, it was a long period of time when people were riding stagecoaches.
Well, it might have been 25 years for this part of the state. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was longer mm-hmm. in other parts. And I think that reference was for this part of the state.
And something else surprised me, too, because sometimes I get weary thinking about, a 14-hour plane ride. And then you say that a stagecoach ride could be 24 hours.
From Reading up to Mount Shasta.
Which is not far. I wish people would, hear again what you just said. How far was that ride?
From Reading to Mount Shasta today takes an hour in a car.
Hour in a car. And it would take 24 hours by stagecoach.
That aspect of early American living has baffled me or amazed me. And someone like John Muir, who every time you pick up anything, he was here, he was there, he was everywhere. Mm-hmm. And he traveled by foot, he traveled by stagecoach. The man was absolutely amazing. And he did play a role in this story. Minor role, but nevertheless a role.
Yeah, I always enjoyed when you reference John Muir in your book. So these kinds of statistics just were amazing that people would do this. Then you also mentioned Here Came the Railroads, and that changed the picture.
Yes, dramatically. Well, it allowed for north-south traffic quite thoroughly, and that was a major breakthrough. You know, I think you heard about Oregon farmers bringing back cattle from California and bringing them to Oregon. It also created vacation culture on the Upper Sac, which I treat quite thoroughly in the book. I mean, the Upper Sacramento River, which is roughly defined as the river above Mount Shasta. But that became a major vacation destination for wealthy people from San Francisco and then more broadly from other parts of the state, even from Europe.
And presidents came to this part.
Many presidents.
California.
One of them were the four or five that I cited as being guests and visitors along that railroad corridor, staying in some of the key
places.
Giving
a talk from the train
at a little
place like Dunsmuir.
That's exactly right. So that was quite a phenomenon about the Upper Sac. And, of course, the quality of the water, which I, again, describe very, very thoroughly. It's so mineralized and so pure.
Just so rich. People are wondering, you mentioned Rutherford Hayes, President Taft, Theodore Roosevelt stopped in Dunsmuir and gave a talk. Woodrow Wilson made a train stop there in Dunsmuir. And then there was one that...
You left that. I know who you're getting to, but H.W. Bush was also in there. So now...
Well, and then the rumor was that President Kennedy had a little tryst there, perhaps.
That's right.
That's the rumor.
There's some evidence of that rumor.
With Marilyn Monroe.
Exactly right.
You can uncover all sorts.
You don't want to dwell on this, do you?
No, I don't. But I just thought your research took you in some interesting directions,
yes.
I'll have to say. So the railroad then had to create several bridges across.
Yes.
And the 18th one in particular was problematic.
Yes.
And why was that?
Well, the Cantera Loop is how we refer to that. And that is a narrow part of the river in a canyon. So in order to make that turn to continue either north-south or south-north, they had to come up with some architectural design. And the rumor has it that someone just walked by, I think a local sheep herder, and suggested, well, you're going to have to go up this side of the river and come down that side of the river. And that became the design. But in the process, it created a very hazardous part of the railroad track. Trains had to slow down to almost 5 miles an hour to negotiate that. And ever since that was put in, there were accidents, many accidents, but none as devastating as that which happened in 1991.
Mm-hmm. That's in our recent memory.
Yes.
We can remember it was July of 1991, that horrible, tell people what happened.
Well, railroad cars slipped off of the track and crashed over what was a very fragile guardrail and dumped this metam sodium into the river when the cars spilled over. And it was not even listed as a toxic material, but it was extremely hazardous. And it made its way all the way down, 40 miles down the river to Mount Shasta.
And I don't think you mentioned everything. It's a pesticide. It's a pesticide.
That's right. It's a pesticide, and it killed everything in its wake, the water and the shoreline, all the organisms, all the fish, and mammals and birds began losing their life. Now, amazingly, the river was able to heal itself, as rivers are capable of doing.
And that's what I thought that was interesting, too, because when we see something like that, we want to fix it. We're so devastated. I mean, it was so sad reading that part of your book. And yet, then the good news was what you're just saying right now.
Yes, a couple of very courageous biologists held off on the fish planting, which the local residents, of course, immediately wanted to restore their economy, and said, no, let the river restore itself naturally. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, that's what happened. And in a remarkably short period of time, 3 or 4 years. Now, an addendum to that little story is just within the past 2-3 weeks, there was an accident on that very loop. So even though that guardrail has been tremendously bolstered, it is still very hazardous, very mm-hmm. hazardous.
Mm-hmm. And this, the pesticide that destroyed the river, when people are destroying the economy, so people who we've got to put fish back in the river. And these biologists were the cooler heads that prevailed and said, no, let's wait.
Right.
But now, that wasn't always the case when it came to stocking the river. And I was amazed. People were bringing salmon from the Atlantic Ocean to put where Pacific salmon lived.
And vice versa.
That just didn't make sense. They call it acclimatization.
Exactly. Yeah. Fish. One of our major fish biologists, the president of Stanford.
Oh, I was horrified by what he said in your book. That's one of the quotes I wrote down.
Exactly. Quite amazing what we did. And, you know, it wasn't only fish. We just introduced all kinds of exotic species. But fish happened to be a great example of introducing all these exotic species that really changed the ecology of all the places where they were introduced.
Because here was a guy who was president of Stanford University. He was an ichthyologist, so you'd think he would have a different viewpoint. But in your book, you say he talks about fishes which man can make no use. I thought, oh, that's the only purpose fish serve. Mm-hmm. If they can't serve a use for us, then we don't need them.
Yes.
That sounds like agribusiness's argument that people's needs are more important than fishes. Yeah.
Now, fortunately, and I treat this very thoroughly in my book, we've turned the corner in the 1960s with the value placed on the wisdom of nature and all of the environmental laws that were passed at that time, and realizing that no, native creatures are more important than introduced creatures, and the natural processes of our waters and lands are really what we should be emphasizing, not these man-made structures.
My guest is Bob Magic. He lives in Anderson on the Sacramento River, and he has written a book, The Story of the Sacramento, A Transcendent River. This book causes not just the it's not more than just information. I found it touched my emotions. Like I mentioned, that I was horrified that here's a person who studies fish and has no regard for the fish. And one water scholar that you quote, Mark Reisner, said, in the finest California tradition, as if tomorrow would never come. And that's the way I think we have looked at things. Well, we'll do this, and we won't, and no thought down the road for tomorrow. For example, there was this period of time, like the 1930s, you call it the glory days of dams.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what's your opinion on these dams that were built?
Well, you know, the theme of the book, the major theme of the book, which I wanted to put out there in a forceful manner, is the power and beauty of a natural river. And rivers are extremely important. I can't think of anything more important to the health of the planet than free-flowing rivers, what they do. And among their many, many functions is to transport nutrients and cobble and sediment from the mountains down to the ocean, to the estuary. And vice versa, to allow migratory species like salmon, sturgeon, to make their way up the river. So once you put a dam in place, that immediately controverts the purpose, that function of the river, those many functions of the river, and just stifles it. So dams have been highly destructive to the natural processes. They were put in place for many, at the time, I suppose, valid reasons, water storage, flood control. But I think we reached the point where we realized that many of those purposes didn't have to be achieved in that particular manner, that gross manner. And we've gone into an era of taking down dams.
Well, during that time, too, in these glory days, you mentioned about the amount of concrete in the Shasta Dam. I mean, Shasta Dam is huge. And just the concrete alone in that dam, you said, You could make a sidewalk around the earth.
Yes, you know.
With the concrete that's in Shasta Dam. And people probably know that Oroville is the highest dam in the United States.
Correct, correct.
So we are surrounded by these dams that at the time, the intelligence, the human intelligence said, this is what we need. We need hydroelectric power. All these reasons that dams from that point of view were good. And you give the opposite viewpoint.
But the two major or the primary reasons for both of those dams, Shasta and Oroville, was to create a garden and an urban metropolis in the southern part of the state. Those were the primary reasons.
Southern part of the state.
Exactly.
Which is by nature a desert.
An arid area.
Well, there's a chapter in your book about the Delta. So tell people what the Delta is. Because if you're from east of the Mississippi, you might have another notion of what the Delta, or the Nile Delta. So what is our
Delta?
Well,
every river has a mouth that is capable of just expanding over many, many hundreds of square miles before it leaches out to its final destination, the ocean. So that is the Delta. The other name for it is the estuary. And as I mentioned, as one of the quotes in the book is, you know, all living things are attracted to estuaries. So estuaries are extremely critical to the health, not only of the river, but of our planet. So the Delta has assumed that importance. But there again, we really engineered it down to a fraction of what it used to be. What it used to be was this tremendous wetlands. In fact, the whole Sacramento Valley was this tremendous wetlands. And here the levees restricted the flows into the Delta, created all of this agricultural land, which has its benefits, but it changed the character of the Delta. And then the diversions, again, to bring water to the south, impacted the quality of the Delta to the effect now that the Delta is in danger of collapsing as an ecosystem. And this is why there's so much emphasis on the Delta smelt, which is an indicator of the health of the Delta, and also on salmon, which is another indicator of the health of the Delta.
Now, you mentioned wetlands, and I think in some people's minds they equate wetlands, oh, that's worthless swampland.
Yes.
That's what it looks like from our point of view as human beings.
That's how it was treated.
As worthless swamplands.
Right. Right.
And you mentioned that the Delta where rivers flow in, which two rivers are we talking about?
We're talking about, of course, the Sacramento, the largest river, and then the second is the San Joaquin, another major river, which was thoroughly transformed into almost being so adversely impacted that it ceased being a functioning river.
Well, you also deal with the recreational aspects that the river provides, certainly fishing. And there was a quote that I wrote down by an author, David Peterson, because people who are animal lovers might think, oh, hunters, that's bad. But here's what he said. He said, compared to factory farming, ethical hunting is a truly benign and honorable, not to mention healthy, way to get your meat. And so I think some people would maybe haven't realized that what we do to animals in factory farming.
Yes.
And here is a river when these natural habitats offer this opportunity. And then here was another quote by one of the most unlikely, a quote from a president now, that in my own mind, here's this president who goes out big game hunting. But here's a quote from him in your book. The wildlife today is not ours to do with as we please.
Teddy Roosevelt.
So I thought, oh, that gives me a different view of this president, if he realized that.
Yes, yeah. Well, he was our great conservationist. So even though he was a great hunter and a great man with guns, he was our strongest conservation president.
Well, so I like that quote. But one of my very favorite quotes, I remember a quote in Walden, Thoreau says, we need the tonic of wildness to wade sometimes in marshes.
Yes.
He goes on and talks about the birds, and he talks about wildness as a tonic. And then in your book, you say that Thoreau revealed a universal truth when he wrote, who hears the rippling of waters will not utterly despair of anything. We go to the river's edge for comfort, spiritual renewal, meditation, solitude. We go to the river to feel and know the continuance of life. Now, I don't spend a lot of time at the river, where it is actually the river, but I spend a lot of time a few miles before the water gets to the river, and that's at Big Chico Creek. I have my little spot there. And when I sit there, sometimes I wonder, like you did, what about the people, the Native Americans, who lived here and worked the river? And I wonder, in my little spot, did these Native Americans come to this little spot? It seems so insignificant. But Thoreau says, you go to the river's edge for comfort, for meditation. And sometimes I'm treated to delights like a beaver.
Yes.
River otters.
Yes.
Raccoons. Maybe some people are not so fond of raccoons, but I'm just amazed that what I can see there. And also, there was a horseback rider that you quote in your book. And she goes down to the river, and she says she marvels at how the river changes from week to week, month to month, season by season. Its color, volume, configuration, and current often differ with each visit. So each time she comes to the river, she too is different, bringing with her that day's moods and thoughts. And of course, there's that quote about no man steps in the same river twice. Mm-hmm. But I would add, now she says from week to week, you're quoting her, that it changes week to week. I see change day to day.
Yes.
When I go cloudy. Down there. Sometimes the water's clear, sometimes it's flowing more freely, mm-hmm. sometimes it is cloudy, and sometimes there along the sides of the bank, there are new growth. It's springtime, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. their leaves are falling and they're floating on the water. And I can spend so much time there and feel it's worth every minute. And I just imagine you and your wife being able to look out, I'm guessing this, look out your back window and see this marvelous river.
You know, I'm going to just let you keep talking because you are expressing the heart of the book.
Oh, that's what I was saying. Your book, not only did it provide information, but it really touched my heart to read like this quote from Thoreau, because I know I've experienced that going yes. down from yesterday to the day before and seeing this change in this little part of the creek. And when I see a squirrel come down to take a drink, I'm thinking, oh, I hope all of you people who live upstream from this little squirrel realize that we need to keep this water clean for these animals here.
Yes, yes.
And I really enjoyed your book because it brought home how important it is for all of us to be good stewards of this beautiful river.
Well, you're expressing it as well as can be expressed.
Well,
I'm so pleased that you are able to point to those things in the book and the pictures and the quotes that you're quoting. These are an attempt to develop that emotional response. Yes.
Well, I might mention for listeners, too, that in addition to enjoying looking at the river, you also enjoy fly fishing. And there's a paragraph. I hope people who get your book will look at that paragraph that you describe the joy of fly fishing, because not being a fly fisher myself, I didn't really see the joy that you found. And so it helped me say, oh, that's why people enjoy fly fishing.
Well, I think one of the quotes is everyone goes to the river and finds his own purpose.
That's a wonderful way to conclude. Thank you so much. Bob Magic. His book is The Sacramento, A Transcendent River. I've invited Bob back next week to talk about his latest book, Ebby's Tale, From Shelter to Stage. I'd also like to thank my first guests, ornithologist Roger Lederer and former English professor Carol Burr, authors of Latin for Bird Lovers. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.